and salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and today my co-host is Blue Frontier's Natasha Benjamin. Hey, Natasha.
Hey, David. Good to be here.
And today we're talking with big wave surf photographer and documentary producer Sachi Cunningham. But first, some blue news you can use. One-fifth of the world's oil shipping goes through the Strait of Hormuz at the bottom of the Persian Gulf. Or right now it doesn't go through, since the U.S. and Israel went to war with Iran on February 28th. When I was there years ago working on my Coast Guard book, the Persian Gulf already smelled like a gas station. Now at least five oil tankers have been hit by Iranian fire, with at least one ablaze, while to the south in the Gulf of Oman, the U.S. reports destroying nine Iranian warships, sinking them in what Seven Seas magazine describes as, quote, one of the world's most ecologically fragile marine environments, unquote. Not so much with the seafloor now scattered with marine hulls, fuels, oil, and ammunition. Other ships, petrochemical facilities, and coastal infrastructure have been hit heavily in Iran and around the Persian Gulf, also on Lebanon's Mediterranean coast, even in the Indian Ocean off Sri Lanka, where a U.S. sub sank an Iranian frigate. This all bodes ill, not only for the global energy market, global economy, and of course men and women and children, both military and civilian, who've been killed or remain in harm's way, but always last on that list when it comes to the environment of war is the environment itself. And with this President Trump's war of choice, the marine environment is particularly vulnerable. As with the Black Sea off war-ravaged Ukraine, it may take years to begin to understand the damage happening right now. And so, sadly, that's blue news you can use. Now back to the show. Welcome back. Sachi Cunningham is a journalist and was the founder of the Los Angeles Times video team, where she produced the award-winning Chasing the Swell series. She's perhaps best known for her in-water photography with a focus on women surfers and her soon-to-be-released documentary, Big Wave Women, about the quest for pay equity while riding giants. She's also just co-written a fascinating article for Bay Nature magazine about the physics, hydrology, and biology, including limpets and sea stars, of the waters of Mavericks, the world-renowned big wave surf break south of San Francisco. So lots to cover, Sachi, but let's start where we usually do. What was your first experience of the ocean?
Well, my first experience would have been in Southern California at Capistrano Beach in Southern California, where my grandparents, my dad's parents, used to rent a beach house for 2 weeks every summer from when I was born till pretty much my whole life. And so I spent a lot of time on that stretch of coast. We had a place on Beach Road that we used to stay in, and I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, so that was a very glorious 2 weeks that always stood out, and I spent the whole time in the ocean. I think I was always in love with the ocean from as long as I can remember. You know, with any contact in the ocean, I was in it, and would always just wonder why the heck we were moving back to Pittsburgh. So when I had any say in the matter as an adult, I moved to California as quick as I could, and I've been here now longer than anywhere else in my life.
So how'd you actually get to California and connect back with the ocean?
After teaching English, and I also worked in Japan for a year, traveled around Asia, stopping in surf places, and fell in love with water surf photography, and drove across the country from Pittsburgh as soon as I landed, and, you know, with a couple hundred bucks, but an aunt who was willing to put me up in her apartment in Los Angeles until I found a job, which I was able to do pretty quickly in film. And that was the start of it.
Amazing. You didn't start out as a surf photographer. Can you tell us a little bit about how you found your way into this big wave surf world that you're kind of now in the middle of?
I was working in feature film production and commercial production in LA, and also doing freelance surf photography. So just trying to pursue that on my own, you know, on the weekends, finding people to shoot with and just traveling to places where I could practice it. And so the surf photography was always there from my early 20s. I was in LA and working for Demi Moore, her production company, and one of her producers had a nephew that was a surfer. He was actually a Maverick surfer and he lived at Ocean Beach. And so I eventually moved in with him and was introduced to the whole Ocean Beach surf community. And then I went to grad school at Berkeley, worked at the LA Times, married my husband, one and only number one husband. And he and I moved from LA. We rented a truck and he was working at NPR and I was at the LA Times, but we wanted to start a family. So we went on a baby making tour of the Americas. We quit our journalism jobs, bought a truck and drove across the Pacific coast of the Americas from LA to Chile. And during that trip, towards the end of it, I applied for the only job that seemed available that I could apply for, which was this teaching job, tenure track teaching multimedia journalism at San Francisco State. And so it's that job that I eventually found out I got when we were in Chile. I also found out I was pregnant by then. So all's well that ends well. And we moved back to Ocean Beach. It was really just a dream that was perfect because I already knew that ocean and loved that ocean. And so that's when I really kind of got into the bigger waves. When my first stint in San Francisco, I was going out into big surf, but it wasn't really by choice. I wasn't necessarily seeking the big waves. It's just I lived in a place that had big waves, and that's kind of what was, you know, at my doorstep.
It's what was there. So for distinctions, let's point out, since I had my lost decade in Ocean Beach, San Diego, that you moved to Ocean Beach, San Francisco, which is a much rougher wave. And to backtrack a little, I assume that first camera was an Iconis, but most people, they get into surf and they start surfing and then maybe discover photography. Or like my friend Wayne Levin, you go to, you know, art school and focus on photography and then discover the water. But you say you sort of discovered your passion as water photography kind of when you pretty early. What's the story? What was your camera and how have you taken it from there?
I was introduced to surf photography as an idea when I was in Pittsburgh. I was 16 years old and this is the era of dial up television. And my dad was watching a documentary on PBS about a water photographer from San Diego named Aaron Chang. And he just called me. He says, "Sachi, come down here. I think you might be interested in this." Because at that point, I wasn't very interested in photography. I was loved the ocean, loved body surfing, and was a swimmer. And I had no idea until I came down and saw this guy swimming in waves with a camera. I didn't even know it was a thing that you could have a camera in surf, that all of my things could be in one place. My love of photography, my love of the ocean, my love of the waves. And so I think I was just kind of gobsmacked and like, what? Like, that's a thing you can do. And so I was a high schooler in Pittsburgh. I had a camera. I had a DSLR camera, but I certainly didn't have regular access to the ocean. So I just stored that idea in my head as something, I'm going to do that someday. And when I had my first job out of college teaching English in Japan and was able to save up enough money, I bought a camera. It was film back then and looked at all of the surf magazines in Japan and looked at the, you know, mastheads and cold called photographers to see if I could shadow one of them. And one of them let me follow them and showed me a few things and kind of opened the door, and the rest is history, I guess.
You were saying you moved to Ocean Beach and you started with pretty significant wave force there.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of followed your subjects into bigger and bigger waves till you were down at Mavericks.
I was working a lot with Bianca Valenti, who is a local surfer and big wave surfer. And she was surfing more and more at Mavericks and surfing the bigger waves. And so in large part, my motivation and inspiration came from her going out in the bigger surf and her accompanying me out in the bigger surf. I mean, really kind of holding my hand. There is also a body surfer locally named Judith Sheridan, who used to surf all of the biggest days at Ocean Beach and at Mavericks. And she's also someone that's been a great mentor over the years. She's the one who I first swam out with at Ocean Beach. I was on the shore watching people surf and knew my skills weren't good enough as a surfer to get out there, but I had a hunch I could probably get out there swimming. And I got some binoculars in the parking lot and looking and watching and saw a little orange fluorescent orange cap bobbing up and down and looked closer and was like, I think that's a woman. And of course, that's all I needed to know to motivate myself to think I could do it as well. And so I swam right up to her and asked her if she could, you know, talk to me, tell me what she's doing. And she taught me everything I know, really. She's incredible. And she's had a lot of people, she told me years and years later that she has had lots of people ask her to take them out and body surf with her. And she's like, you're the only one who swam out and asked me.
So you were teaching by then. Freelancing's not an easy gig. And obviously surf photography is probably a whole other level of not being able to make a living. So how have you evolved surf shooting and particularly focusing on the women in the sport as a way to find outlets and develop your skills and your livelihood?
How do I pay the bills? Well, I don't always pay the bills, but I have chosen these things that I love that are not that lucrative: documentary filmmaking and water surf photography. So that's where journalism, actually in grad school, the journalism school at UC Berkeley, that's where that came in. I was working more in feature and more in scripted feature film and commercial production. Before then, I was an assistant to Barry Levinson, the director, producer, and as I mentioned to me more, and I was interested, I wanted to start making documentaries, realized I didn't know what I was doing. And so that's when I applied to the school at Berkeley, where I studied under John Else. They have, you know, within the School of Journalism, they have a documentary track. And so every single project I did while at school, when I could, I pitched some ocean-based story, something that would get me in the water, because, you know, I was like, if I'm going to pay for this, I'm going to do the stories I want to do. And I think I got really lucky with timing also, in that my class was really the first class that was graduating, I mean, kind of in the country, that had the skills of being a one-person band, you know, knowing how to make a video, shoot it, produce it, edit it all as one person. And that's right at the same time that video is being introduced at all the major newspapers. And so all of the people in my class, there were 10 per class in the documentary track, and most of us got jobs that didn't exist when we started the program, but were in demand when we graduated. So a lot of people went on to the New York Times video team. I was at Frontline World. I started their first online video program. So I was part of the team that was, putting together their first multimedia packages. And then I got a job. You introduced me as the founder, it sounds nice, but I don't know that I would credit myself with founding it, but I was the first video team at the LA Times. So it was the first time the LA Times was devoting a budget and a team to only doing video. So that's basically, I've been paying the bills by doing the video journalism work and then doing all of the passion projects on the side. And then, you know, eventually teaching journalism and with the passion projects on the side.
We want to hear about Big Wave Women, which I know you've been working on for a while. And I was fortunate enough to see a rough cut recently and very excited about it.
That evolved from a journalism assignment. Actually, I was covering a gathering of a dozen women who were invited to an invitational event at Mavericks. They couldn't have an official contest. It was just about having fun, a free surf kind of and gathering. And I covered that for the San Francisco Chronicle and for Surfline. And I was finishing up a documentary at that point in time. I had a newborn at home, so I was not looking for a new project, but at that point had been pursuing surf photography specifically of women for nearly two decades, and all of a sudden had 12 of the world's best big wave surfers right in front of me doing something that had never happened before. And what excites me most about journalism is being able to record this first draft of history. And it was very clear that history was being made right before my eyes. And so I was just like, oh, shoots, I guess I'll press record. So I was shooting photos and writing those stories, but I did shoot video that day also because I knew it would be valuable and that I would probably want to pursue a story. And of course, the women that I chose to focus on, Bianca Valenti, Paige Oms, Calla Kennelly, and Andrea Muller, were the best in the world and continued to prove themselves as the best in the world and prove that they wanted to do more than just surf big waves. They wanted to change the sport. And so eventually their activism through using levers of California Coastal Commission's mandate to protect equal access to the coast and California's mandate to pay people equally, they were able to use both of those in order to get the World Surf League to pay women and men equal prize money and become the first sports league in history to have equal pay. And I had the camera rolling the whole time. So that's what I'm in the process now of finishing.
And it's not just a story of equal pay. It's also just these women weren't part of this competition.
Yeah, with access.
Access.
Yeah.
So important stories, lots of important ocean stories to be told.
And exciting too. I mean, pay equity is great in middle management, but when you're looking at women riding waves the size of mountains, it's a lot more visually exciting.
And the visual analogy is pretty simple, right? If these women can scale these huge mountains of water, what else can they do? I think it changes the way people see women. Just one photo. It's like watching Evel Knievel jump over the Grand Canyon. You know, it's the neuroplasticity is there in one moment.
And I opened my book, The Golden Shore, California's Love Affair with the Sea, at Mavericks on the biggest paddling contest they ever had. And I remember talking to one of the top placers afterwards. We're having a discussion about plastic bags, whether you should charge a fee or ban them. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm talking to somebody who on the one hand is just like a typical Californian. On the other hand, he's one of like maybe 100 humans who are able to ride, you know, 6 and 8 story waters, waves. And I think, you know, so you're profiling some women who are, you know, at that extraordinary level of kind of Olympic athletes. And I remember when I was writing Rescuers, my Coast Guard book, and visiting the Rescue Swimmer AST Training Center, the instructors, I'm going, so they must have that like black dots floating around them when they're being held under and you have that lack of oxygen. And he goes, oh yeah, we practice that for the third week of training. We don't want to scare them in the first week. Uh-huh. I imagine that over time you've gotten more used to hold downs and that you sort of experienced that in your work?
I have not had too many incidents, fortunately. I'm pretty conservative, actually, in the risks I'll take. I want to come home to my family. So I am taking very calculated risks, but I have gotten more calm or more. It's a mental game as much as anything, maybe more than the physical ability to hold your breath. It's that knowledge and experience of knowing you're going to survive, that everything's going to be okay. It's also just, I've done breath holding courses that are geared towards big wave surfers. And when you train yourself to hold your breath for 4 minutes in a pool, you know, you do the math, you're like, okay, well, the biggest swell that I'll probably ever be in is going to be probably around 20 seconds in between each wave. So 3 wave hold down, that's 60 seconds. that's, you know, no problem, I guess, is the mental math you do and the confidence that I go into the water with. The most dramatic and frightening thing that happened was at Ocean Beach when I went out actually with safety in mind. I wore a helmet, which I usually do at Mavericks. I don't always do at Ocean Beach, mostly because there's not that many people around me. So, you know, it's not an issue of really boards hitting me. But on that day, it was huge. I was not going out with Bianca or anyone specifically who we could do the buddy system with. So I put on a impact vest that's embedded into the wetsuit. So I had the helmet and then I had the extra flotation. And at first, you know, my calculus there was like, okay, well, if something happens, at least I'll be floating on the surface. But I at first thought it was a brilliant idea because with that extra flotation, every time I went under, I didn't have to use any energy to get back up. I just kind of immediately popped back up because of that flotation. Eventually realized why it was a really dumb idea at Ocean Beach specifically, because the waves, because it's a beach break and the waves are all over the place, a little harder to calculate, you know, when and where you should be in order to avoid the impact zone. And because the waves are coming nonstop that day anyhow, and it wasn't a short interval, but anyhow, you have to dive really deep, really fast. And this huge wave came and I just couldn't get deep enough fast enough. And so I just got blasted. I mean, I didn't even have any time to think. I actually pride myself on, I had never let go of my camera. That is the one time I've ever let go of the camera. And I had no choice in the matter. Like it just was like car crash. It just was like, and the camera housing hit my helmet. I was like, thank God it hit my, you know, leg. I was just totally freaked out after that.
So instead of hypoxia, instead of lack of oxygen, you got beat to death almost by these waves.
By myself.
Yeah. You're floating.
By your camera.
Yeah. Yeah. So I never wear a flotation for that reason at Ocean Beach anymore. I do wear a helmet on big days because you can hit yourself with the housing. That's the biggest danger, is your own housing.
And then, but you still went back, right?
I did. I went back. I mean, I went in, but I did go back eventually. Yes.
So I'm going to snake Natasha's question, because it just reminded me that crazy women just aren't in waves. They're also swimming long distances. So
yes.
I gather one of your new projects is Catherine or Karen Breed, who's planning to swim the length of California.
Yeah. Catherine Breed, Cat Breed. Who has a project called Swim California, where she's going to swim the length of California, about 900 miles from Oregon to Mexico. And yeah, Natasha and I are both working on that, trying to make sure that it's documented and that her story and the stories that occur along the way are told. And of course, the stories of the ocean that she's hoping to give more voice to are also told along the way.
Yeah, I think that's kind of one of the unique pieces of this project, is Catherine's going to do this amazing thing, swim the entire coast, which has never been done before, and use the swim to elevate ocean conservation stories, which is ultimately when you love the ocean and you spend time in the ocean, whether you're surfing big waves or open water swimming, you form a natural connection and want to protect and elevate that. And I really respect what Catherine's doing in terms of that, and very excited to be working with you to document the story.
Thank you. Me too. And, you know, I think it's this unique opportunity. You always need at least us humans usually like stories about other humans. You know, you want to find this human connection, and, you know, all the little creatures that we don't see under the sea don't have much of an opportunity to tell those stories. It's a unique opportunity to cover the entire coast.
Yep. And give a voice to some of those, you know, the things that we don't see under the water. And like you said, Sachi, that once you saw, you know, you saw another woman in the water, it kind of gave you not permission, but, you know, just like, oh, I could do this too. So that's, yeah. you know, seeing Kat in the water, seeing these big wave women surfers really is so, it's so important for this next generation to see other women doing these things.
Absolutely. Can't be it without seeing it.
We've seen bits and pieces of your work with these women. When is a good time where people might actually be able to see big wave women and the whole documentary tale of these incredible surfers?
I am hoping that it'll be in festivals as soon as, you know, this summer, fall. We have to go through the whole festival circuit. So we'll be applying to festivals hopefully this summer, which means those festivals, if they accept it, won't be probably till the fall or winter. You know, it's this kind of waiting game. Of course, if some streamer wants to license it before then, we're all for that too. The goal is just to get it seen by as many people as possible. So there's different avenues for that, but ideally it's ultimately streaming on a major, you know, video on demand service. I hope to have an impact campaign tied in with it so that we can not only have it streaming on some major service, but also taking it out to audiences that, you know, will enjoy it and where it can have the most impact. And that includes with policy. And, you know, one of the components that I like about their story is that they used California Coastal Commission's mandate for equal access to the coast. They use existing laws to create this change. And I think that that's a lesson, inspiration, and toolkit that we hope to kind of remind people of, things like Title IX and other levers that we have to create change. I think it's good to have stories that remind people, give people hope, and also remind people that the tools are out there. It's just about, you know, knowing how to access and use them and implement them.
Yeah. Well, while we're waiting for Big Wave Women to come out, we can see your work coming up in the Bay Nature article and some of your writing and photography. So excited to see that.
Their website we can go to see your work?
I have a photo website that's seasachi.com, seasachi.com. And seasachi is also my Instagram handle where I have a lot of my work.
Well, thank you so much, Sachi, for being on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. It was a total pleasure to talk about all things ocean.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the blue frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.